For long seconds, Jake stood over it, panting with exertion and reaction. Then he leaned forward and touched with his fingertip the long pale lashes that fringed the lion's open, staring golden eye. Already the sheen of the eyeball was clouded by the corrosive liquid. At Jake's touch, there was no blinking reflex, and he knew that the animal was dead. He turned to find that Vicky had not obeyed his instruction to run. She stood frozen where he'd left her, naked and vulnerable, so that he felt his heart shift within him, and he went to her quickly. With a sob, she flew into his arms and clung to him with startling strength. Jake knew that the embrace was the consequence of terror, not affection, but as his own heartbeat slowed and the tingle of the adrenaline in his blood receded, he thought that he'd achieved a solid advantage. If you save a girl's life, she just has to take you seriously, he reasoned, and grinned to himself, still a little unsteadily. All his senses were enhanced by the high point of recent danger. He could smell the perfumed soap and the stink of ammonia. He could feel with excruciating clarity the slim, hard length of the girl's body pressed to his and the smooth warmth of her skin under his hands. "Oh, Jake," she whispered brokenly. And with sudden, aching certainty, he knew that in this moment she was his to take, to possess, right here on the black rock bank of the Awash, beside the warm carcass of the lion. The knowledge was certain, and his hands moved on her body, receiving instant confirmation. Her body was quick and responsive, and her face turned up to his. Her lips trembled, and he could feel her breath upon his mouth. "What the hell's going on down there?" Gallus' voice rang across the murky depths of the gorge. He stood at the top of the bank, high above them. He had one of the Lee Enfield bolt-action rifles under his arm and seemed on the point of coming down to them. Jake turned Vicky, shielding her with his own big body and slipping off his moleskin jacket to cover her nakedness. The jacket reached halfway down her thighs and folded voluminously under her armpits. She was still shivering, like a kitten in a snowstorm, and her breathing was broken and thick. "Don't worry about it," Jake called up at Gareth. "You weren't in time to help, and you aren't needed now." He groped in his hip pocket and produced a large, slightly grubby handkerchief, which Vicky accepted with a tearful, quivering smile. "Blow your nose," said Jake. "Then get your pants on, before the whole gang arrives to give you a hand." Gregorius was so impressed that he was speechless for several minutes. In Ethiopia, there is no act of valour so highly esteemed as the single-handed hunting and killing of a full-grown adult lion. The warrior who accomplishes this feat wears the mane thereafter as a badge of his courage and earns the respect of all. The man who shoots his lion is respected. The man who kills with a spear is venerated. Gregorius had never heard of one killed with a single rock and a bottle of ammonia. Gregorius skinned out the carcass with his own hands. Before he'd finished, the black pinioned vultures were sailing in wide circles overhead. He left the naked pink carcass lying in the riverbed and carried the wet skin up to the bivouac where Jake was fretting to continue the trek towards the wells. He was irreverent in his disdain of the trophy, and Greg tried to explain it to him. "You will gain great prestige amongst my people, Jake. Wherever you go, people will point you out to each other." "Fine, Greg, that's just fine. Now, will you kindly haul ours?" "I will have a war bonnet made for you out of the mane," Greg insisted, as he strapped the bundle of wet skin to the sponson of Jake's car. "With the hair combed out, it will look very grand." "It could only be an improvement on his present hairstyle," Gareth observed dryly. "I agree it's been a beautiful honeymoon, and Jake is a splendid lad, but like he said, let's move on, before I'm violently ill." As they moved towards their respective cars, Gregorius fell in beside Jake and quietly showed him the mushroomed, copper-jacketed bullet he'd removed from its niche in the pelvic bone of the carcass. Jake paused to examine it closely, turning it in the palm of his hand. 9 millimeter, or 9.3, he said. "It's a sporting caliber, not military. I doubt if there is a single rifle in Ethiopia that would fire this bullet, said Greg seriously. It's a foreigner's rifle. No need to blow the bugle yet, said Jake, and flicked the bullet back to him. But we'll bear it in mind. Gregorius almost turned away and then said shyly, Jake, even if the lion was already wounded, it's still the bravest thing I ever heard of. I have often hunted for them, but never killed one yet. Jake was touched by the boy's admiration. He laughed roughly and slapped his shoulder. I'll leave the next one for you, he promised. They followed the windings of the River Awash through the savanna grassland, running in towards the mountains, so that with each hour travelled the peaks stood higher and clearer into the sky. The ridges of rock and the deep forested gorges came into hazy focus, like a wall across the sky. Suddenly they intersected the old caravan road, hitting it at a point where the steep banks of the Awash flattened a little. The ford of the river had been deeply worn over the ages by the passage of laden beasts of burden and the men who drove them, so that the many footpaths down each bank were deep trenches in the red earth that jinked to avoid any large boulder or ridge or rock. The three men worked in the brilliant sunlight and swung shovel and mattock in a fine mist of red dust that powdered their hair and bodies. They filled in the uneven ground and deeply worn trenches, levering the boulders free and letting them roll and bounce down into the riverbed, and slept that night the death-like sleep of utter exhaustion that ignored the ache of abused muscle and burst blisters. Jake had them at work before it was fully light the next morning, clearing and levelling, shovelling and packing the dry, hard-baked earth, until at last each bank had been shaped into a rough but passable ramp. Gareth was the first to take the car through, and he stood in the turret, somehow managing to look debonair and sartorially elegant under the fine layer of red dust. He grinned at Jake and shouted dramatically, "Noli illigent menti par carborundum," and disappeared into the steel interior. The engine roared, and he went bounding and sliding down the steep ramp of newly turned earth, bounced and jolted across the black rock bottom, and flew at the far bank. When the wheels spun viciously in the loose red earth, blowing out a storm of grit and pebbles, Jake and Gregorius were ready to throw their weight against it, and this was just sufficient to keep the vehicle moving. Slowly it ground its way up the almost vertical climb, the rear end kicking and yawing under the thrust of the spinning wheels, until at last it burst out over the top, and Gareth shut down the power and jumped out laughing. "Right! Now we can tow the other cars up the bank." And he produced a celebratory cheroot. "What was that piece of dark Latin you recited just then?" Jake asked, as he accepted the cheroot. "Old family war cry," Gareth explained. "Shouted by the fighting swells at Hastings, Agincourt, and in the knock shops of the world." "What's it mean?" "Noli illegitimi carborundum." Gareth grinned again as he lit the cheroots. "It means, don't let the bastards grind you down." One at a time, they brought the other three cars down into the ravine and hitched them up to the vehicle on the far bank. Then, with Vicky driving, Gareth towing, and Jake and Gregoria shoving, they hauled them up onto the level, sun-baked soil of Ethiopia. It was late afternoon when at last they fell panting in the long shadow thrown by Miss Wobbly's chassis, to rest and smoke and drink steaming mugs of hastily brewed tea. Gregorius told them, "No more obstacles ahead of us now. It's open ground all the way to the wells." And then he smiled at the three of them, with white teeth in a smooth, honey-coloured face. "Welcome to Ethiopia." "Quite frankly, old chap, I'd much prefer to be sitting at Harry's bar in the Rue Daunou," said Gareth soberly. "Which is exactly what I'll be doing, not long after Toffee Sagood presses a purse of gold into my milk-white hand." Jake stood up suddenly and peered out into the dancing heat waves that still poured from the hot earth like swirling liquid. Then he ran quickly across to his own car and leapt up into the turret, emerging seconds later with his binoculars. The others stood up uneasily and watched him focus the glasses. "Rider," said Jake. "How many?" Gareth demanded. "Just the one. Coming this way, fast." Gareth moved across to fetch the Lee Enfield and work a cartridge into the breech. They saw him now, galloping through the dizzy heat mirage, so that at one moment horse and rider seemed to float free of the earth, and then sink back and swell miraculously, growing to elephantine proportions in the heat-tortured air. Dust drifted behind the running horse, and it was only at close range that the rider came into crisp focus. Gregorius let out a bellow like a rutting stag and raced out into the sunshine to meet the newcomer. In a brilliant display of horsemanship, the rider reined in the big white stallion, so abruptly that he plunged and reared, cutting at the air with his forehooves. With white robes billowing, he flung himself from the horse and into Gregorius's widespread arms. The two figures joined together rapturously, the stranger suddenly seeming small and delicate in Gregorius's arms, and the cries of laughter and greeting high and bird-like. Then, hand in hand, looking into each other's faces, they came back to the group that waited by the cars. "My God, it's another girl," said Gareth with amazement, setting the loaded rifle aside. And they all stared at the slim, dark-eyed child in her late teens, with a skin like dusty silk and immense dark eyes fringed with long, curling lashes. "May I introduce Sarah Sagood?" asked Gregorius. "She is my cousin, my uncle's youngest daughter, and she is also, without doubt, the prettiest lady in Ethiopia." "I see what you mean," said Gareth. "Very decorative indeed." As Gregorius introduced each of them by her name, the girl smiled at them, and the long aristocratic face with the serenity of an Egyptian princess, the delicate features and chiselled nose of a Nefertiti, changed instantly to a sparkling, childlike mischievousness. "I knew you must cross the Awash here. It is the only place, and I came to meet you." "She speaks English also," Gregorius pointed out proudly. "My grandfather insists that all his children and his grandchildren learn to speak English. He is a great lover of the English." "You speak it well," Vicky congratulated Sarah, although, in fact, her English was heavily accented, and the girl turned to her, smiling anew.
"The sisters at the Convent of the Sacred Heart in Berber taught me," she explained,
and she examined Vicky with frank and unabashed admiration.
"You are very beautiful, Miss Camberwell. Your hair is the colour of the winter grass in the Highlands."
And Vicky's usual composure was rocked. She blushed faintly and laughed. But Sarah's attention had flicked away to the armoured cars.
"Ha, they are all so beautiful. Nobody has spoken of anything else since they heard these were coming."
She hoisted the skirts of her robe up over her tight-fitting embroidered breeches and hopped agilely onto the steel body of Miss Wobbly.
"With these, we shall throw the Italians back into the sea. Nothing can stand before the courage of our warriors and these fine war machines."
She flung her arms wide in a dramatic gesture, then turned to Jake and Gareth.
"I am honoured to be the first of all my people to thank you."
"Don't mention it, my dear girl," Gareth murmured.
"Our pleasure, I assure you." He refrained from asking if her father had remembered to bring the cash with him, but asked instead, "Are your people waiting for us at the wells?"
"My grandfather has come with my father and all my uncles. His personal guard is with him, and many hundreds of others of the Harari, together with their women and animals."
"My God," growled Jake. "Sounds like a hell of a reception committee."
They camped that last night of the journey on the bank of the Awash, under the spreading umbrella branches of a camel thorn tree, sitting late and talking in the ruddy flickering glow of the fire. Secure were the square fort formed by the four hulking steel vehicles. At last the talk died away into a weary but friendly silence, and Vicky stood up.
"Short walk for me and then bed."
Sarah stood with her.
"I'll come with you."
Her fascination with and admiration for Vicky was increasingly apparent, and she followed her out of the lager like a faithful puppy. Away from the camp, they squatted side by side in companionable fashion under a night sky splendid with starshot, and Sarah told Vicky seriously,
"They both desire you greatly, Jake and Gareth."
Vicky laughed awkwardly again. Once more,
discomposed by the girl's direct manner. Oh, come now.
Oh, yes. When you come near them, they are like two dogs, all stiff and walking around each other, as though they will sniff each other up the tail.
Sarah giggled, and Vicky had to smile with her.
Which one will you choose, Miss Camberwell?
Sarah demanded.
Lordy, do I have to?
Vicky was still smiling.
Oh, no,
Sarah reassured her.
You can make love with both of them. I would do so.
You would? Vicky asked.
Yes, I would. What other way can you tell which one you like best?
That's true. Vicky was becoming breathless with suppressed laughter, but fascinated by this bit of logic. The idea had a certain appeal, she admitted to herself.
I will make love with 20 men before I marry Gregorius. That way I'll be sure I have missed nothing, and I will not regret it when I am old, declared the girl.
Why 20, Sarah? Vicky tried to keep her voice as serious as the girl's.
Why not to 23 or 26?
Oh, no, said Sarah primly.
I would not want people to think me a loose woman.
And Vicky could hold her laughter no longer.
But you,
Sarah returned to the immediate problem.
Which of them will you try first?
You pick for me, Vicky invited.
It's difficult, Sarah admitted. One is very strong and has much warmth in his heart. The other is very beautiful and will have much skill.
She shook her head and sighed.
It's very difficult. No, I cannot choose for you. I can only wish you much joy.
The conversation had disturbed Vicky more than she realized, and although she was exhausted by the long, hard-driven day, she couldn't sleep, but lay restlessly under a single blanket on the hard, sun-warmed earth, considering the wicked and barely thinkable thoughts that the girl had sown in her mind. So it was that she was still awake when Sarah rose from her bedside and, silently as a wraith, crossed the laager to where Gregorius lay. The girl had discarded the robe and wore only the skin-tight velvet breeches, encrusted with silver embroidery. Her body was slim and polished as ebony in the light of the stars and the new moon. She had small, high breasts and a narrow, moulded waist. She stooped over Gregorius, and instantly he rose, and hand in hand, carrying their blankets, the pair slipped out of the laager, leaving Vicky more disturbed than ever. She lay and listened to the night sounds of the desert. Once she thought she heard the soft cry of a human voice in the darkness, but it may have been only the plaintive yelp of a jackal. The two young Ethiopians had not returned by the time Vicky at last fell asleep. The radio message that Count Aldo Belli received from General De Bono on the seventh day after leaving Asmara caused him much pain and outrage.
"The man addresses me as an inferior,"
he protested to his officers. He shook the yellow sheet from the message pad angrily before reading in a choked voice.
"I hereby directly order you..."
He shook his head in mock disbelief.
"No, request. No, if you please,
you notice." He crumbled the message sheet and hurled it against the canvas wall of the headquarters tent and began pacing in a magisterial manner back and forth, with one hand on the butt of his pistol and the other on the handle of his dagger.
"It seems he does not understand my messages. It seems that I must explain my position in person."
He thought about this with a burgeoning enthusiasm. The discomfort of the drive back to Asmara would be greatly reduced by the superb upholstery and suspension designed by Mrs. Rolls and Royce, and would be more than adequately offset by the quasi-civilized amenities of the town. A marble bath, clean laundry, cool rooms with high ceilings and electric fans, the latest newspapers from Rome, the company of the dear and kind young hostesses at the casino. All this was suddenly immensely attractive. Furthermore, it would be an opportunity to supervise the curing and packaging of the hunting trophies he had so far accumulated. He was anxious that the lion skins were correctly handled and the numerous bullet holes were properly patched. The further prospect of reminding the general of his background, upbringing and political expendability also had much appeal.
"Gino!"
he bellowed abruptly, and the sergeant dashed into the tent, automatically focusing his camera.
"Not now, not now!"
The count waved the camera aside testily.
We are going back to Asmara for conference with the general. Inform my driver accordingly.
24 hours later, the Count returned from Asmara in a mood of bile and thunder. The interview with General De Bono had been one of the low points of the Count's entire life. He'd not believed that the general was serious in his threat to remove him from his command and pack him off ignobly back to Rome, until the general had actually begun dictating the order to his smirking aide-de-camp, Captain Crespi. The threat still hung over the Count's handsome, curly head. He had just 12 hours to reach and secure the wells of Chaldi, or a second-class cabin on the troop ship Garibaldi, sailing 5 days later from Massawa for Napoli, had been reserved for him by the general. Count Oldobelli had sent a long and eloquent cable to Benito Mussolini, describing the general's atrocious behaviour, and had returned in high pique to his battalion, completely unaware that the general had anticipated his cable, intercepted it, and quietly suppressed it. Major Castellani did not take the order to advance seriously, expecting at any moment the counter-order to be given. So it was with a sense of disbelief and rising jubilation that he found himself actually aboard the leading truck, grinding the last dusty miles through rolling landscape towards the setting sun and the wells of Chaldi. The heavy rainfall precipitated by the bulk of the Ethiopian massif was shed from the high ground by millions of cascades and runnels, pouring down into the valleys and the lowlands. The greater bulk of this surface water found its devious way, at last, into the great drainage system of the Sud marshes, and from there into the Nile River, flowing northwards into Egypt and the Mediterranean Sea. A smaller portion of the water found its way into blind rivers like the Awash, or simply streamed down and sank without trace in the soft sandy soils of the savanna and desert. One set of exceptional geological circumstances that altered this general rule was the impervious sheet of schist that stretched out from the foot of the mountains and ran in a shallow saucer below the red earth of the plain. Runoff water from the highlands was contained and channeled by this layer and formed a long, narrow underground reservoir, stretching out like a finger from the base of the Sadi Gorge 60 miles into the dry, hot savanna. Closer to the mountains, the water ran deep, hundreds of feet below the earth's surface. But farther out, the slope of the land, combined with the raised lip of the schist layer, forced the water up to within 45 feet of the surface. Thousands of years ago, the area had been the grazing grounds of large concentrations of wild elephant. These indefatigable borers for water had detected the presence of this subterranean lake. With tusk and hoof, they dug down and reached the surface of the water. Hunters had long since exterminated the elephant herds, but their wells had been kept open by other animals. Wild ass, oryx, camel, and of course by man, who had annihilated the elephant. Now the wells, a dozen or more in an area of 2 or 3 square miles, were deep excavations into the blood-red earth. The sides of the wells were tiered by narrow worn paths that wound down so steeply that sunlight seldom penetrated to the level of the water. The water itself was highly mineralized, so that it had a milky green appearance and a rank metallic taste. But nevertheless, it had supported vast quantities of life over the centuries. And the vegetation in the area, with its developed root systems, drew sustenance from the deep water and grew more densely and greenly than anywhere else in the dry, bleak savanna. Beyond the wells, in the direction of the mountains, was an area of confused, broken ground, steep but shallow wadis and square hillocks, so low as to be virtually only mounds of dense red laterite. Over the ages, the shepherds and hunters, who frequented the wells, had burrowed into the sides of ravine and hillock, so that they were now honeycombed with caves and tunnels. It was as though nature had declared a peace upon the wells. Here man and animal came together in wary truce that was seldom violated. Amongst the grey-green thorn trees and dense scrub, goat and camel grazed in company with gazelle and gerenuk, oryx and greater kudu, In the hush of noon, the column of four armored cars came in from the east, and the hum of their engines carried at distance to the multitude that awaited their arrival. Jake led as usual, followed by Vicky. Then came Gregorius with Sara riding in the turret of his car, and the white stallion trailing them on a long lead rein. In the rear rode Gareth. Suddenly, Sara shrieked, at such a high pitch that her voice carried over the engine noise, and she pointed ahead to the low valley, filled with green scrub and taller, denser trees. Jake halted the column and climbed up into the turret. Through his binoculars, he studied the open forest, and then started as he discerned a horde of moving figures, coming headlong on wings of fine, pale dust. "My God," he muttered aloud. "There must be hundreds of them." And he felt a stab of uneasiness. They looked anything but friendly. At that moment, he was distracted by the sound of galloping hooves close by, and Sara came dashing past him. She was mounted bareback on the white stallion, her robe streaming and fluttering in the sun-bright wind. She was shouting with almost hysterical excitement as she galloped to meet the oncoming riders, and her behavior reassured Jake a little. He signaled the column forward once again. The first ranks came swiftly in dust clouds, on running camels and galloping shaggy horses, fierce, dark-faced men in billowing robes of dirty white, and a motley of other colors. Urging forward their mounts with wild cries, brandishing the small round bronze and iron-studded and bossed war shields, they came racing towards the column. As they approached, they split into two wings and tore headlong past the startled drivers in a solid wall of moving men and animals. Most of the men were bearded, and here and there, some warrior wore proudly a great fluffy headdress of lion mane, proclaiming his valor to the world. The manes rippled and waved on the wind as the riders drove by, urging on their mounts with the high "Lulu!" ululations so characteristic of the Ethiopians. The weapons they carried amazed Gareth, who as a professional dealer recognized 20 different types and makes. Each one of them a collector's piece, from the long muzzle-loading tower muskets with the fancy hammers over percussion caps, through a range of Martini Henry carbines, which fired a heavy lead bullet in a cloud of black powder smoke, to a wide selection of Mausers and Schneiders, Lee Metfords, and obsolete models from half the arms manufacturers of the world. As the riders swept by, they fired these weapons into the air, long spurts of black powder against the evening sky, and the crackle of musketry blended with the fierce ululations of welcome. After the first wave of riders came another of those on mules and donkeys, moving more slowly but making as much noise, and immediately after them came a swarming mob of running, howling foot soldiers, mingled with whom were women and shrieking children and dozens of yelping dogs, scrawny yellow curs with long whippy tails and ridges of standing hair running down their skeletal backbones. As the first rank of riders turned, still lulooing and firing into the air to complete the encirclement of the armoured column, they ran headlong into the following rabble, and the entire congregation became a struggling mob of men and animals. Jake saw a mother with a child under her arm go down under the hooves of a running camel, the child flying from her grip and rolling in the sandy earth. Then he was past, forging ahead through a narrow path in the sea of humanity.